Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here with my co-host, Laura Chan Baker.
Hello.
Hello. Season 5. Who knew we would last this long? But we have. We're back, and after 3 weeks of no rest at all, and we're ready to get the show rolling. To those of you who've been with us from the start, hi, Laura's parents.
Hello.
Maybe my parents, maybe other people.
Not Clara, who in our office never listens to our show.
Thank you so much for your support and for the emails and everything else. And to anyone just joining us, we promise we've got a great one for you today. And guess what? It is time to read the opener. Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. Every week, we come together in the doggy daycare that is our recording studio and dissect three different links that we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as a jumping off point to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we're going through our open tabs and we'll be discussing the benefits of silent meetings, U.S. immigration, and our deepest, darkest fears. Helping us bring some outside perspective today is our very special guest, Luke Malone. Luke gets around. He started out writing for magazines and newspapers in Australia before moving to New York, joining our cavalcade of Australians in New York that we seem to really focus on here.
Yeah, we've definitely got a theme.
Once there, he decided to write, but also started producing TV documentaries and podcasts for places including This American Life, Gimlet Media, and Showtime. A couple of years back, he wrote a National Magazine Award-nominated feature about teenage pedophiles and began traveling around the U.S. giving talks on child sexual abuse prevention and contributing to academic books on the topic. He's currently working as a story producer for FX Network's first true crime documentary series. Luke, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Luke, Jeremy and I are nervous. You're a pro.
You're so pro. I've heard your voice on a series of very popular podcasts. I feel very familiar to you.
Yeah, my Australian squawk on various podcasts. No, I feel like I'm an expert. I am not, but I'm like a very, very eager participant. Let's put it that way.
Well, we like an eager participant. So, Luke, thank you so much for joining us. It's very exciting to have you here. It's also very exciting to be back in the hot box for season 5. Crazy, crazy stuff. Jeremy, how are you going?
I am doing okay. I've returned from my California sojourn with Bianca. And yeah, feeling very sad at the moment, seeing what's kind of happening there at the moment with the fires. And also very grateful that we got to, experience a lot of that landscape as well before we kind of left.
And you've had fires in your area as well here in Australia. So
yeah, obviously not as bad. But yeah. Obviously our thoughts got to everyone over there. We were over there over for Halloween as well. So had a nice Halloween in the forest, actually. Did you do anything special at all here?
Not at all. I live in Yarra, which is like Western Melbourne, and it's like a real like community, and there's an area called The Village where there's like all the little shops and stuff, restaurants and clothing shops and whatever. And they all go like fucking hardcore on Halloween, which is weird in Australia because it doesn't really happen. And suddenly at like 4 o'clock, there's like 9,000 children in the middle of the village. And so I just stayed very far away from it.
All with just white hair and white eyes, just kind of, staring.
That's
at
a
you.
Different kind of scene, Jeremy.
Luke, do you get up to Halloween at all? Do you do the candy? Do you do pennies? Do you do books? Or do you just kind of shut the door?
I feel like I am a bit too old for candy. I'm at least doing the whole door
to give it away.
I know, yeah. To give it away. Well, I'm in an apartment, so I don't have to kind of engage with any kids, luckily. But yeah, so basically I do what I do every year. I think, what did we do? We went to like a party and then there was like a midnight screening of Halloween, I think, funnily enough. So yeah, kind of like somewhere in the mid-ground.
Well, it's November now and we're still kind of catching up, but I thought it would be appropriate to have a bit of a Halloween segue for this first link.
I
love a segue. Laura, get us started. What do you got?
Okay, so this is a piece from Ad Age, and it's basically just a big collection of responses from people throughout the advertising industry, brands, tech companies, publishers. And the question that they're responding to is, what scares you right now? And look, it's a scary bloody place out there. So I really want to talk about it with you guys. I want to know what terrifies you. You all know that I love turning the podcast into a little bit of a therapy session. But first, just a quick glance at how the piece starts. So the piece begins, it doesn't have to be Halloween for you to be scared these days. Boogeymen are everywhere, starting with the White House. At an industry level, ghosts and ghouls are especially thriving. And we're not even talking about the goblins the Me Too movement has exposed. A brief rundown of our more familiar spooks, holding company stock values are in the tank, even when that market is purring, which it hasn't been. Big consumer brands are slashing ad spending, notably in the digital space. And when they are making ads, they're increasingly opting to do them in-house. ad blocking has wreaked havoc. Traditional ad impressions are in the toilet. When the duopoly is not devouring most of every digital dollar, Facebook and Google are playing fast and loose with our data. Also, Kanye. So from there, it goes into all the various answers from the dozens of sources that they canvassed across sort of all corners of the industry. And look, now I have my favorites, but I want to hear yours first. Luke, did any of these resonate with you or surprise you at all?
I wouldn't say like surprise me. I feel like some of the people speaking from like media, and you can't see, but I'm doing like air quotes. It weren't super surprising, but I kind of do share a lot of the anxiety about kind of where things are going. I came from print, so I don't know. I feel like print has had a particularly rough trot over the past 10 years. Like, I mean, media is always in flux, but I feel like print, like once the internet came around, like I'm kind of giving away my age there, but once the internet came around and like HuffPo came on board and kind of really changed what writing and print journalism was, it kind of created this odd market where a lot of people who were doing this professionally were kind of like nudged out in favor of kind of bloggers and people who were just writing for a bit of fun. And it kind of did things to the market that still hasn't quite recovered from, I don't think.
Imagine this sort of stuff has had an impact on your career. Like, as you said, you know, people who are doing this stuff for a living, people have had to shift how they make a living out of writing or content producing or whatever because of the shifts in the ways that that stuff is paid for. So like, how has that impacted like where your career has gone?
Gosh, good question. Because it actually has quite a lot. I mean, when I first started out freelancing, like I used to get paid quite a lot, like a dollar a word. Depending on the publication.
That doesn't happen these days.
No, not at all. And this wasn't that long ago. And I mean, I'd kind of, you know, write a piece that was like 800 words. It'd take me, depending if it was a reported piece or just kind of something else, it could take me like, I could pump out like one of them in a week or one of them, like two of them in a day, depending. But I could always get myself a nice, steady little salary. And then just before I left Sydney, like the market, the pieces that were paying me a dollar a word would now say, oh, we're going to pay people $300 per article, which was like less than half of what I was getting. And I had decided to take some time out anyway to go back and get my master's in the US. And then when I finished that, I was like, oh God, it's kind of terrifying. And the opportunities for a writer or, you know, a print reporter weren't what they were just a couple of years before. So that kind of made me really think about what it was I wanted to do and look about how I could kind of combine my journalism experience with things like TV documentary and podcasts and things like that.
Yeah, because I guess that is where the money is now. Because I started in writing as well, and I genuinely fear for people who are studying writing currently. Not. I mean, it's the skills that I think people absolutely should have and should hone. But in terms of people who are still thinking about going into a traditional writing career, I don't know that that exists anymore. That's possible. Jeremy, what of these resonated with you?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, they all really resonate with me in a different way. I kind of think that it's interesting because that fear and advertising often go hand in hand. Like, you know, you need to make people scared of things to make them kind of buy something and kind of do something. And there's obviously a huge climate of fear in general at the moment. So I feel this kind of tapped into a lot of kind of deep things. So obviously people were kind of responding to things on a political basis or more kind of humorous personal basis. And then just, yeah, with all the kind of things that are kind of happening, I think the general thing that I feel is there's so much kind of happening and nobody kind of knows where it's going to go. So there's a lot of kind of uncertainty in the industry, which I think is creating this kind of.
But has that always been the case? Like, is that not always what it's like? Aren't there always people sort of crying out that, you know, advertising's dead, publishing's dead, media's dead, whatever is dead, and we don't know what we're going to do unless we change by this time next year, everything's fucked.
I think it felt though, I mean, in my subjective experience, like maybe 10 years ago, for example, that the amount of things that you had to kind of consider was less. Mm. And it feels now there's like, you know, everyone's kind of reacting to kind of a different thing. So it's like, there's Kanye, there's politics, there's climate change, there's Bitcoin, there's talent, there's data. And it seems to be kind of coming just at everyone, like in a very kind of overwhelming sense. And I think, yeah, some people have a pretty level-headed approach and some people, you know, feel a bit differently, obviously. I'm amazed at how they got so many people to kind of
really high up people. They got like some pretty big names on this list.
Yeah, in terms of kind of content, Ad Age has been doing some great stuff. I mean, there's probably over 100 kind of blurbs here. I'm not sure how they kind of had the chops to do that. So obviously they have the budgets to go and kind of get this data, which I think is great. So
yeah, I mean, my favorites were the ones that were just quite honest. Like even if they weren't the ones that I necessarily resonated with on a personal level, like for example, I really liked this one. It's from Andrea Brimmer, who's the Chief Marketing and Public Relations Officer at Ally Financial. And she says, My biggest fear is inadvertently getting caught in a political firestorm. It could be something you don't even do, but your brand ends up dragged into. It's a different world we live in. It's so divided right now. I'm afraid of losing control of the brand. It's such a precious asset and you work so hard to protect it. This is a new dynamic we've never had to deal with before. We used to have total control of the brand, but now with social media, we don't. And I think that's something like a lot of people and a lot of companies are feeling right now, but probably don't admit. So I thought this was quite, I don't know, quite an honest response. And it's true, I think, and it's something that's even truer with each day that goes on, you know, that in this current climate, for better or for worse, it's no longer possible to fully control a company's image, and all companies and people for that matter are kind of at risk of being irreparably damaged by voices and forces that are completely outside of their control. So I thought that was an interesting response. I also like this one because, again, I felt like it was sort of an honest representation of what a lot of ad people and brands are feeling right now. So this is from Jason Levine, who's the North America CMO for Mondelez International. Side note, I did have to YouTube how to pronounce Mondelez.
Mondelez.
That's what I thought too, but apparently it's Mondelez. There you go. Learning every day. So he says, as I'm trying to keep on top of the latest trends, the latest tools, the latest technologies, I'm constantly worried about chasing the shiny new penny down a rabbit hole and being Alice in Wonderland. There are questions around what's the best way to produce content, how we're approaching managing data, how we're managing our brand ecosystem in a more omnichannel way. There's so much change happening in the industry. I want to make sure that we take our time to do the right thing. So that, I think that kind of touches on what you said, Jeremy, in that there's so much happening. And because of that, people aren't sure which lead to follow. And I think that's a really real fear in the industry currently.
What's your gut feeling? I mean, what would be your greatest fear if you had to put something in here?
Oof. I mean, it's tricky because, I mean, in terms of greatest fear, if I want to keep it to like my industry, so let's say commercial art industry, I mean, we've talked before about my fear of kind of total homogenization of how things like sort of social media encourage everyone and everything to look the same. And that's definitely one thing that scares me about the commercial art industry and where it's going. I mean, not about the arts in general. I think there will always be uniqueness in art. I have no doubt about that, no concern about that. But when it comes to the commercialization of art, I think this move towards a truly global economy has some really wonderful effects, but it also has the effect of kind of watering down all our differences and making all of our comms, including, you know, the artwork used in those comms, look very similar. And it's something that we see happen again and again. And I don't know, it scares me, I guess, on a personal level, because it's the complete opposite reason of why I got into this industry in the first place. And of course, you know, I'm also scared of like waning budgets and the splintering of sort of media campaigns, and therefore, you know, that slice of the pie getting smaller for all these talented artists and, you know, people that need this income in order to keep creating the stuff that I love to look at as an agent. That's something I'm scared of. And then more generally, obviously big things, war, Trump, climate change. But one thing that did come to mind, which is, I guess, less about our industry and more maybe about just my community, my society, my country. One thing that I think about really often is kind of the lack of financial literacy that's afforded to people who don't already come from financially literate families. Like, I worry about the level of debt and the lack of super and that sort of inherited low understanding of managing finances that so many people are born into or have dumped upon them. And I think that's both really unfair and really dangerous. And that kept coming up for me when I was reading this, because I think that feeds into a lot of the other issues that people are scared of. And, you know, clowns, spiders, all the other scary stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the interesting thing that I kind of saw as well. Like, all these kind of things are so kind of linked together. I mean, yes. All those kind of general financial things that you're talking about really kind of play into the discussion we had on privilege and creativity the other day as well, and making sure that we have kind of new voices kind of in the industry in that mm-hmm. way, you know, and talking about data as well. Like, I mean, Squarespace, old David Lee, the CCO of Squarespace, his fear was when everyone is reacting to the same data, it's very easy to fall into the trap of optimizing your brand to a point where you begin to sound and dress exactly like your competitors. It was interesting. I was kind of having a chat with a few people in our meetings in California. I was like, well, like, how are you guys finding kind of talent? And everyone's just like, you know, Instagram, like that's kind of where it's happening. But like, how reliable is that? Like, when there is kind of an algorithm that's kind of showing you more of kind of what you want to see, or it isn't giving you a fully, I guess, objective kind of feed.
And I also just don't know how you combat that. Like, if you wanted to, like, how do you, I mean, I actually don't know.
Is it about kind of like, just on that one though, about Instagram, I don't know, if there's kind of analogous to, I think, what happened a lot in newsrooms. I think people started chasing like the Facebook algorithm for articles. And if you got something, got like some pickup on Facebook, it would just completely change your kind of revenues for that week, for that day, whatever. And I think we became super reliant, and you're so dependent on this organization that's not your own, and it feels like you're safe and in control. But then the second like Facebook decides to kind of like change the algorithm, you bottom out and you're pretty much fucked. And I think that same thing can happen actually with Instagram. You're so reliant on these companies. And I think it's incredibly dangerous for an industry or a brand or a label or an outlet to be reliant. But it's kind of hard to pull away from that if that's what people are looking towards at that time, right?
Completely. And one of the, coming from that, one that came up a few times, but particularly well put by, it was Nicholas Carlson, who's the global editor in chief of Business Insider, is this sort of idea that when you've got algorithms feeding you more and more of what you already want, what also happens is that you, and I always talk about this on the podcast, is this kind of split of, we no longer have this shared reality where we all see everything. It's kind of people see more of what they want to see and you get further and further into your own bubble. So Nicholas said, the other night I was flipping between the cable news networks and it was like they were reporting on alternate universes, each with a different set of facts. I'm terrified of filter bubbles. I'm terrified of news companies joining the war on truth because they have a commercial incentive to appeal only to one side of the political spectrum. That's not journalism and it doesn't serve our society. Luke, what do you think about that?
Gosh, I think it's a sad reality. I mean, I don't know. I'm in two minds, really. I feel like I don't know if before when it was just papers, for example, I think it was really self-selecting. I think if you're not interested in international politics, you're not going to read that section. You know what I mean? So I think before you could already kind of edit your reality. This is just basically the same thing on steroids. But having said that, I think it's really important to not just consume the same media that you do every day. Like I was speaking to a friend the other day and he said he watches Fox News for half an hour a day. And he like swings liberal. And I was like, oh God, half an hour a day seems intense. And he's like, no, I think it's like really important. And then he's a documentary filmmaker. And he's like, I think it's important just to see what, like you said, these alternate realities, what they're kind of, what facts they're putting forward and what things they're focusing on. And I think to not do so is kind of negligent. And then I felt actually bad for not watching Fox News for half an hour a day.
I mean, I think you'd feel bad if you did watch Fox News half an hour a day, so it'll swing both ways. Just to wrap up, I would love to end with this one that came from Charles Wigley, who's the chairman of Bartel, Bogle, Hegarty, BBH, Asia Pacific. And I just thought, in the end, if we are talking strictly about industry stuff, this one resonated with me the most. He says, there is nothing to be scared of. We have the privilege of making ads, light bits of cultural fluff that occasionally get caught by the digital breeze and catch on. We're not doing brain surgery or nursing the sick or trying to get the rest of our troops out alive after a firefight. Anyone who is kept awake at night by the doings of advertising is potentially in need of some form of care.
Oof. I had that same conversation yesterday, actually, at work. I don't know.
I have to remind myself of that sometimes. You know, like sometimes you come home and you're all at work, you get so stressed and you're freaking out. And eventually you have to just think like, this is an ad for toilet paper. Like, why am I, tearing my hair out?
I think it's because you care about it, right? So I think because we all kind of care. I assume most of us care about what we do every day and spend our time doing. So I think that's what lets you get kind of worked up and stressed. But I don't know, then you kind of sit back and think like, who cares? I mean, I always kind of think about it, whether it be an article. I mean, some articles are more important than others, but back when I was making podcasts, sometimes I'd be like, you could remove this podcast from the earth tomorrow and like nothing would happen. There'd be no butterfly effect. You know what I mean? Like no like forest fires would start, no animals would die. It'd just be like into
the
void.
It's depressing, but it puts things in perspective. I mean, I don't mean to say that I should like not care about the work that I do, but sometimes it's like you should care to a point, but not when it destroys you.
Well, look, there's a lot of really interesting points being made here. I think in general, when you look at kind of fear as an emotion or kind of what the utility of it is, it usually kind of, gives a sign that there's kind of a threat or kind of something's wrong. And so I think if anything, these kind of give you some really kind of good counterpoints of what you can do or, ways you can go to alleviate some of these fears. And I think especially when I look at something like, okay, what is Apple doing with news, for example, bringing kind of more humans kind of into the newsroom and kind of curating, more of their kind of content, that's a direct reaction against, people being dissatisfied with kind of data collection and data reading in that way. But yeah, have a read for yourself where we will post this as we do every week to our show notes where you can read this and all the links that we talk about this week before we move on to our next one. Okay, next up, it is my turn. Here's a link that's three times removed, entitled A Silent Meeting is Worth 1,000 Words. This is from Square's Medium accounts going over silent meetings, but this is actually kind of, it originally came from something that Bianca posted, a Quartz article on the rise of the silent meeting, which referenced in turn Amazon's approach to the tactic. But yeah, I'm taking kind of Square's approach in it, which is a bit different. Look, I always thought I was hip to all the new office trends, but I have to admit that this was the first time I'd ever heard of this. And it really struck me on a number of levels. And I wanted to kind of pick it apart with you guys specifically. So look, firstly, a bit of an overview. The author of the piece, whose name is Pi, I don't know what his full name is. It's not on Twitter. It's not on Medium. It's very frustrating, but he's an Android developer.
He's like Prince.
Sorry?
He's like Prince.
Well, he doesn't even have a symbol.
Madonna.
Anyway.
No, he's got two swords. He's got a symbol. There we go. Two swords. Pirate?
Two swords.
Is he a pirate?
Probably. I think that's the safest conclusion.
Well,
continue, Jeremy.
He is also an Android developer at Square. He posted about their method, which is a modified version of Amazon's process, which is actually outlined in a 2012 article in Fortune. I'll post a link to that article as well, even though we won't be discussing it. But look, basically, instead of gathering everyone together for just an ad hoc meeting or planned meeting, everyone kind of starts with a 6-page memo. Everyone sits together in silence for as long as 30 minutes with hard copies of the memo and then scribbles notes into margins. So that was the Amazon method. And Jeff Bezos says the active communal reading guarantees the group's undivided attention. Writing a memo is an even more important skill to master. Full sentences are harder to write, he says. They have verbs. The paragraphs have topic sentences. There's no way to write a 6-page narratively structured memo and not have clear thinking. Now, so Square kind of took that and they made a different kind of play on this, using a Google Doc outline and asking and answering questions via comments. But the whole concept is basically the same. So look, on the one hand, there's a lot that I really like about this. Pi talks about building a culture where all thoughts can be equally voiced and heard. You know, so it doesn't kind of allow one person to kind of dominate a meeting or someone who has something that they really want to say not be heard. I also like the idea of bringing in this period of kind of deep focus, like as opposed to sometimes more frenetic and responsive nature of meetings. On the other hand, I really feel the more kind of ad hoc and verbal nature of meetings has its own special quality that allows for more serendipity and sometimes surprising results, which I feel that, I don't know, this could potentially kind of stymie. So look, Luke, I really want to get your take first, especially because amongst all of us, you have the most experience in larger organizations, but also because of your extensive experience in the podcasting medium, which even though it's a oral medium, you know, coming in through your ears, a huge amount of writing and planning goes into what's being said so much, like especially in those highly produced shows that you've worked on. So I thought you might have some unique insight here. Have you ever participated in a silent meeting at all? And do you think it could work if you haven't? And why? Just curious to hear your thoughts on it.
Sure thing. Yeah, I haven't. I haven't taken part in a silent meeting. And funnily enough, when you first sent the link across, I kind of opened up the tab and I was like, oh God, like my eyes kind of rolled out of my head just because the idea of kind of like, oh, like meetings are terrible. Offices are often weird and terrible, and kind of making anything more formal and structured. I don't know. I guess sometimes you can spend like half the day in meetings and structuring meetings and talking about meetings and how they can be better. But having said that, once I actually calmed down and read the article, it does make a lot of sense. I mean, I've often noticed in meetings, there'll be other people, be they kind of just younger or a bit shyer or just kind of newer to the company, and they're super reluctant to sound like an idiot. You know what I mean? And then you get them outside of the room and then you hear, you know, their note or whatever, and it's a really solid note. And the kind of the higher ups don't really hear it, and then they don't get the kind of the benefits from their original ideas. And I think this might be a really, really good way to bypass that. Because I think some people are just better speakers, you know what I mean, and better at commanding a room, and doesn't necessarily mean that their ideas are any better, and that can really kind of squash creativity and originality.
In all the places you've been, this is a bit of a just a general question. Have you ever kind of seen any other approaches to meetings that were a bit kind of novel? Because I think, you know, this is something that's coming up in conversation a lot, especially like when we talk about kind of Basecamp and their kind of approach to the calm office and, you know, different things kind of trying to eliminate meetings. And then this whole idea of Slack, like being in a 24-hour meeting that never stops, which is somewhat like a silent meeting, but everyone's kind of writing as well. So are there any kind of techniques that you've ever seen kind of implemented that actually did that were effective in this way?
Yeah, delete Slack. I hate it. It's so effective and so good, but it drives me crazy. I think what's happened in the past actually is just kind of setting, and this is kind of more old school, just setting an agenda. Like, this is our agenda. These are the 5 things we need to talk about. And this is the 1 thing we need to get out of it. And as long as you have, like, you know, kind of a ringleader who's really good at just shutting people down and kind of moving things along, I think meetings can be kind of effective and short. But funnily enough, most of the time, I mean, it's kind of analogous to edits. Like, doing podcasts, the vast majority of your time is just editing in a communal script. And so what we would do is just it's kind of similar to this. We would just kind of make comments in the side, and people would make their comments on that. And then you'd have, you know, 2 arbiters at the end kind of coming through and just approving or deleting things. And that was a really effective way of kind of just getting ideas heard and then people kind of deciding by committee without kind of being in a room and talking about it for 10 minutes per point. You know what I mean? You kind of write your comment, and then the editor and or host would come through and just be like, yep, no. And if you felt super strongly about something, you could kind of go back and have an argument about it, a respectful argument about it. But I think that can be kind of helpful because it just like saves time. I mean, I don't think many of us have you know, time in the day to spend like 3 hours in a meeting that could be done offsite in like 30 minutes.
Another reason that this piece really resonated with me is that, well, I was recently together with Bea in our US office, and we talked a lot about ways that we can keep our two offices closer together. And a lot of it involved writing and documentation. So it was kind of there to be referred to, especially after. Approach like this seems like it would be ideal for remote teams. Luke, have you worked much with remote teams at all? And like, you know, how do you kind of keep things together? Like, and, you know, especially with meetings when it's the only time everyone's kind of together in one space.
Yeah, that's like kind of the only time I feel like I'd actually advocate for more meetings. Like, I've worked with remote teams. Like the last show I worked at Gimlet was startup, and we had maybe a third of our team was on the West Coast. And it was a bit of a challenge because, you know, decisions would be made. We'd have like smaller meetings or just kind of discussions around the office or at the table about how things should go. And we just wouldn't necessarily think to include them. And it's kind of minor stuff, but that kind of stuff adds up. And then they might fall out of the loop or, you know, it's just kind of hard. So we actually started to implement more face-to-face meetings in that case. And by that, I mean, just kind of Skype meetings, smaller things. And then like after, if we had a big group meeting where it was kind of the connection was shitty and it was hard for them to hear, one or two of us would always circle back and kind of jump on the phone and just say like, you know, what did you take from that meeting? Do you have any questions? What couldn't you hear properly? Just to make sure they felt in the loop. Because I think it's such a challenge.
Because that's the problem, isn't it? Like, we also try to do, same thing happens, where because we're a big team here and a smaller team in the US, this is sort of really the main headquarters, I guess, and we have a lot of little discussions IRL all day, every day, that then, yeah, sometimes we forget to pass them on to the US team. And, you know, poor Bianca and Claire over there, sort of, guys, waving their hands like Sims sort of being stuck in a room. And, yeah, we sort of then tried to, we had a conference call this morning with everyone, but it's really hard to speak up when you are the one on the call, like, and out of the room, because the audio is crap. You can't necessarily hear what everyone's saying. It cuts in and out. And so that follow-up call or follow-up notes, as we sort of tend to do, is really important.
It's interesting. I think it's important to also, I think culturally, to define why you have meetings in your business as well, because it's like, for me, I know sometimes we're having meetings for many different purposes. Sometimes it can be a lazy response. It's like, I can't be bothered typing this. I just want to kind of talk it out, you know, or do we need to be making decisions together? Or sometimes it doesn't even have any reason. It's just like, it's about making FaceTime. Like, you know, sometimes we've had meetings that have no purpose, but to just build kind of some trust up between us and a client, for example. So I think it's important to maybe differentiate what different types of meetings are and having kind of different approaches for them. I think silent meetings could potentially work for something where input is kind of needed to kind of be gathered in some way. But then there are meetings where, for example, we need to kind of, like, information needs to be kind of disseminated and then questions answered. So that could be a different form. So I think it's really, and then figuring out how Slack kind of figures into all that as well. Like, I don't know, but I think the written word is a really big part of this. I mean, in terms of like how you're kind of following up, how you're kind of doing outlines, how you're kind of getting feedback. And usually every meeting, as you say, Laura, does have a kind of a written component at some point, whether it's kind of starting the meeting or after the meeting. I mean, what's your take here? Like, how does, you know, you're such a huge proponent for the written word. How does this reconcile with the idea of meetings?
You know me, language is my best friend. That's really sad. I'm kind of interested to try this. I agree with you that, yeah, you absolutely need to be able to recognize what sort of meeting this is appropriate for. But overall, I mean, it just comes back to my love of prep. You know me, Jeremy. I am the biggest advocate for people doing proper prep and having understandable notes ahead of anything. And so, yeah, extending this to a wider group is interesting to me. And I think in the end, you know, if the person running the meeting or the presentation puts the right prep time into the document that everyone's reviewing and making comments on, then it could be really beneficial. Luke, what you said about there being a ringleader that can sort of keep control of the meeting, I think is absolutely crucial. And not every company or team has that. So meetings tend to be absolutely useless when you end up in that situation. But I mean, with this approach, I really see the main positive coming from the fact that it forces the person running the meeting to be really clear in what they're proposing. So like before they get everyone in the room, they have to have spent time breaking down what it is they're trying to say and putting it into a concise, readable format. And that's helpful, not just for the people they're talking to, but for them as well. As you said, it also makes sure that people are actually paying attention to what's happening because they have to actively read through and comment. But Jeremy, you mentioned this and I was going to mention it as well, so I'm glad you brought it up first. I think you would maybe struggle with the silent meeting approach because as a super busy boss dude, half the reason that you call meetings is because you don't have the time to pull together a structured proposal or meeting deck and you want to get that quick fire response in real life. And I think that would go for a lot of people. I mean, this kind of approach, it really requires that sort of dedicated prep or it's a bit useless. That said, I mean, Luke, like you said, a lot of meetings are kind of useless anyway if the person running them hasn't put enough thought into what they want to chat about. So there might be something to be said for this, you know, read through a document, make comments, silent meeting approach. I mean, yeah, again, Jeremy, like, for example, a really early kind of brainstorming type thing where you really want that messy conversation, it could probably be a bit restricted by this silent meeting model. And also, some things are just really, really hard to explain in text, especially when an idea is in early stages and you maybe don't want to narrow it down too much by making those written statements about it. So I guess, I don't know, it's really hard to prescribe exact guidelines on when the silent meeting could work. So you'd need sort of astute people in the company to be making those decisions based on what sort of meetings you're doing. But I can definitely think of a situation recently where this would have been great. I can't go into too much detail because it's for a super special secret project that we're working on here at Jackie Winter. Jeremy, you may catch my drift. but we had a meeting some time ago where I did take the liberty of drawing up a sort of quite structured document of what we were proposing and all the questions and points to be discussed. And I did that really firstly because I didn't quite understand what I wanted to talk about in the meeting. It wasn't really my meeting I was running, but I didn't quite understand what we're talking about. I could tell that other people didn't quite have clarity on everything we discussed. So I was like, I went to put it on this document. And while I was putting the document, it forced me to really, really clearly think through all the things we discussed in like 19 other meetings that we'd had in the weeks prior. And it was really helpful. And we did use this as an agenda throughout the meeting. But yeah, everyone had such sort of broad and differing opinions. And there were a lot of us in the meeting. And so inherently, like, not everyone could speak on everything they wanted to. And I think this kind of approach could have worked really well in situations like that. And again, also, I mean, unsurprisingly, I am one of the louder interrupting people in meetings that this article sort of talks about. So I guess I'm interested to hear how it would benefit people. You were saying, Luke, maybe people who are newer in a company or perhaps just not as confident speaking, but still have like absolutely wonderful, valid ideas. I mean, I'm really calculated in what I say. I don't just blurt out anything. And I do think really carefully about what I want to communicate before I say it, but I will happily say it as Jeremy's smiling at me now. I think he recognizes this. But yeah, for me, the main interest I have in this silent meeting approach is also a way of giving everyone a real opportunity to gather and consider their thoughts before voicing them or typing them. The reason I love writing so much and we talk about it so much is because writing something down forces you to have clarity. And I think all of us can do with more of that.
And that's why after we get, what I try to encourage as well is that every time we get off a briefing call, for example, or any time we get off a feedback call, that all that is captured in writing as well. Because, you know, sometimes there are things that are said that it's so easy to kind of say something and not realize the kind of repercussions of it. And I think when you write it down, it gives it more kind of form as well.
When you're talking, it's so easy because you feel like you have to keep filling the void. It's really easy to just ramble out with various things. And also, especially if it's a bit more of a brainstormy type thing, multiple ideas will come out in that one session. And it's hard for the people sort of taking that information away to figure out, okay, which one was actually the important one, which was the one we actually want to focus on. So it's like, once you actually put that into writing, you can then sort of place priorities on things. And I don't know, that's really, really important. But yeah, I do find it easy to forget sometimes that not everyone's brain or personality works like mine. And so that, you know, there are probably a lot of people who would benefit from this kind of approach.
Sometimes I feel like I'm more eloquent than I actually am. You know what I mean? Because sometimes I'll be in a meeting and I'll be like, blah, 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 and I have this idea and I speak fast anyway and I mumble and I slur. And everyone's like, huh? Well, they're like, sure. And you know, they didn't quite get it. And then if I write it down, they're like, oh, that's what you meant. You could have just said that. I'm like, I thought I did. So I feel like...
Completely. And I think like that all the time. I'll be in the meetings with other people and I'm sure I do it as well, but I'll be in meetings with someone and I wish they would take the time to write this down. And Jeremy, I do it to everyone and I've forced you to write things down to me before because it forces you to think about what you actually want to say in a way that speaking doesn't.
Oof, so true. Sorry, this whole last 5 minutes I've been trying to be like, how can I work a silent disco joke into this? How can I work a silent disco joke into this? But I can't.
You are wearing headphones.
I am. So look, some really interesting stuff there and some also interesting tech that's kind of emerging around this as well. I'm going to put a link to an app called Pinstriped, which is a new kind of, well, not new, but I looked at it once and it was kind of, it's an app called Pinstriped and it's called, it says your easy way to prepare and run successful meetings. So it's really interesting. It just kind of, it's a web app that lets you kind of, that kind of puts this kind of framework around around having a meeting in terms of getting people on board, outlining the strategy, getting notes and kind of all these things. So it's definitely a problem that other people have kind of faced. And I think Slack in general has been a response to kind of, you know, our culture of meetings as well. So there are kind of things popping up around it. So yeah, we'll put links to all that as well. But otherwise, I think it really just, it just goes to show as well how important a good leader is in a business and establishing culture and, you know, hiring for people who do have kind of writing skills and making sure that, yeah, there are people who are great at kind of just talking. I think, you know, identifying kind of what makes that kind of great group dynamic is kind of something that will allow you to kind of have effective meetings. But yeah, some really interesting thoughts here. I think that'll do us for now, and we'll move on to our final link from here. Our final link of the week comes from our special guest, as always, Luke. Luke, before we go into your link, I always like to ask this to kind of all of our guests. Where did you find this particular link, but where do you kind of generally like to get your kind of content from? Are you a Twitter person, RSS? Do you like to get things emailed from your parents like I do most of the time? What is your internet?
You look for omens in the sky.
Yeah, yes. I'm trying to think.
What is your internet hygiene
I'm
like?
I'm trying to think of the last thing my mom sent me. I feel it was just gossip about my aunties, and there was no actual.
I mean, we'll happily chat about that too.
But yeah, no, I think like a bit of a spread. I mean, I'm kind of basic. I mean, Twitter I use quite a lot. Like every morning, I kind of wake up. It's the first thing I kind of go to just to see if there's anything breaking or anything I should kind of be across. And then on the way to work, I do a lot of my stuff in the morning. So on the way to work, I'll listen to Upfront. Is Upfront Up First? I listen to Up First, which is an NPR podcast, which is like 15 minutes of like the day's news. I'll also look at the daily mail out that the New York Times mails out, just the kind of the more like what you need to know in the morning. And then if I have time or if I'm walking to work, I'll generally listen to the daily, which is also the Times. And I realize I'm really Times heavy, which actually kind of goes to what I was speaking before, that I'm kind of like making my own little bubble.
That's like an hour of your morning already gone. I also spend a shit ton of time reading these things, but then I also realize that that means I'm not eating or not working or not.
Since you mentioned The Daily, which is one of my favorite podcasts as well, I want to talk to you as an audio professional here about some of Michael Barbaro's like weird, like kind of vocal picks. The way he says all the time after everything, is that just me? Like, does that bother you at all? Like, do you kind of like hone into that kind of stuff, or is that just kind of a kind of acute quirk of his hosting style? What's your take there?
I'm always reluctant to talk about people's voices because mine is so ridiculous. But having said that, some mornings I'm like, yeah, this sounds great. Like, carry on, Michael. Other times I'm like, oh, I can't handle his voice. And I kind of like switch it off, which happened this morning, actually.
Also, Jeremy, this is bloody rich coming from you, Mr. Kind of in this way, I guess.
In this kind of way, I guess. It's interesting and interesting. I am the fucking worst. Everyone has it. No, I mean,
yeah, myself included.
But how do you get around that? Like talking about people's kind of like voices, like in, like, you know, it's something that's unavoidable. It's kind of right there.
Considering that he's a guy, I think it's a lot more kind of awkward when we're talking about a woman who's a host, because I think they actually just naturally get a lot more shit for their voices than guys get. That's what I've kind of noticed.
Absolutely.
And it's rooted in misogyny and sexism in many ways, I think.
You're completely right, and that happens all the time. I have lots of friends who run various audio things, and they always get stuff. Although the one thing I've thoroughly enjoyed since we started doing this is I've had so many compliments on my deeply scratchy, terrible voice, and I'm loving it.
Your voice is the best.
Thank you, Jeremy. Your wife tells me that all the time, and it's great.
Okay, Luke, I digress. on a much more serious matter, but still relating to the New York Times, tell us about your link, why you chose it, and yeah, a bit more.
Yeah, sure. So this one is like super personal, but I think it also speaks to the experience of a bunch of Australians in New York, all over the world, but in the New York context. Like Australians in New York, like thick as flies. There are so many of us here. It's a bit much. But anyway, yeah, so I was reading this this article in the Sunday Times, an opinion piece by this poet called Javier Zamora. And Javier is basically, he's a poet. He kind of moved here from El Salvador when he was 9 years old. And when I say moved, he made the journey mostly on foot and was an unaccompanied minor. And this whole piece basically is him talking about getting his green card and kind of in the current climate with the current administration, like what that means for him and how he feels about it. And the reason I kind of brought this one up is because I actually had my green card interview last week. And so it's something I've been thinking about myself for like 6-7 years. I finally got it. But I mean, I want to preface this by saying this, because I think his and my story is very different. I'm white. He's non-white. He's from El Salvador. I'm from Australia. As I said, he came here as an unaccompanied minor when he was 9. I flew here to go to like an Ivy League university when I was 31. So it's like very, very different. But it did make me think about identity and place, not to be too esoteric, but I don't know. I moved here, yeah, 6-7 years ago to further my career mainly. I came here for uni and with the intention of kind of just seeing what would be available here. And my career's opened up in ways I don't think would have been possible at home at the time. I can't really speak for now. And so, but then, so I've always kind of just thought, okay, I'm just going to see how it goes. I might be here for a year. I might be here for two, yada, yada, yada. But here we are, like, you know, creeping up between the 5-year towards the decade mark. And my life is very much in this city and in professionally in this city as well. But I don't know, there's something about getting the green card and it makes you confront your identity, both professionally and just as a person. Like, I'm slowly becoming American. And it's a very different thing now than it was 6-7 years ago. You know, under that time, it was under Obama. Now it's under Trump. And in regardless of whether you're kind of left or right, like, I think it's pretty easy to say that this country is in an incredible state of flux at the moment. And I don't know, I think it's causing a lot of people that I know, at least from Australia, to decide whether they want to stay here and keep taking advantage of the creative and professional opportunities when they weigh up, you know, what else is going on in the country. And again, I want to also say, basically, we're all coming from a point of insane privilege where we can leave whenever we want. But it certainly is a conversation I'm hearing more and more from kind of creatives in New York about whether they want to be in this country and where it's going, whether they feel like this is the place they want to kind of set down roots.
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty heartbreaking read and a good reminder of the dire situation in the US and in a lot of places in the world right now, Australia very much included, when it comes to immigration and asylum seekers. And I always find these really interesting because I am half Mexican myself, but obviously have such a different experience to many Mexicans in the US. I can't speak for my dad at all, but I think I can safely say that, you know, him moving to Australia in the 90s, not at all to sort of flee any sort of danger, but because his, you know, employer sent him here for work, he had such a different experience to so many Mexican immigrants in the US and many other immigrants around the world. And Australia is a country with deep racist tendencies, but lucky, you know, enough for us, this doesn't really extend much to the relatively few Mexican immigrants that are here. Aside from the odd, like, border joke I got as a kid, there's really nothing. And I mean, yeah, it's been interesting, if not scary, to see the shift in how the world views the US, how polarizing it's become, even more so than it always was. I mean, the US as a world power, any world power is always going to be polarizing in some ways. But yeah, I mean, as you said, Luke, the US has always held this really intense allure for Australian creatives, you know, moving to New York or LA or San Francisco, getting a job, building a life. It was always that sort of gold standard of telling everyone you'd made it. And half of my old comrades from my sort of ad agency days have moved to New York precisely because of that, you know, American dream of more culture, more opportunity, more money, more excitement, just more of everything than you'll get in Melbourne or not capital cities in Australia, even more so. You know, I have always wanted to do the same, but I think you're right. I don't know that it quite holds that same allure anymore, at least not so much for me. I think in recent years, something has shifted and America no longer seems to be that sort of beacon of freedom and fortune. I mean, there's still huge appeal, of course, don't get me wrong. I mean, Australia is small, at least population-wise, and it's somewhat isolated. And also anywhere will seem boring if you've been there your whole life. So I definitely understand that idea of wanting to go somewhere different with more opportunity. But I think personally, and it's been quite a recent shift, but I don't know that I see America as that cultural leader anymore necessarily, or necessarily, you know, something to aspire towards. I have many, many frustrations with Australia and with Melbourne, but I think I do grow more of an appreciation for them and what we have here as I get a bit older. And I think my sort of starry-eyed, rose-tinted view is probably faced a little more towards certain parts of Europe now, more so than New York or other places in the States, as it had always been my sort of entire life and particularly my professional life. And that, I mean, look, largely it's probably for political reasons and the sort of cultural effects that those political shifts have had. But I don't know, it's been really interesting. I mean, Jeremy, because you're in the reverse, you are, you know, born in New York and moved here, what, how long ago now?
Oh God, 17 years?
17 maybe? Years. You're an old man. And I mean, like, what keeps you here? Why do you choose Melbourne over New York?
I mean, it's such a loaded topic on so many kind of levels. You know, it's hard to kind of focus, like, on, there's a creative component to it, like, you know, a commercial one and a personal one as well. You know, like, I kind of initially came over here as a response to 9/11, you know, when I was kind of working and living in Manhattan and that happened, I was like, I need to kind of get away for a bit. And I won't kind of do the story here, but I actually did try to claim asylum at DMIA, what it was called at the time, and explaining my home country was a terrorist target. I got laughed right out of the office.
Yeah. as you probably should have.
One of the most humiliating and embarrassing moments in my life. I was only 19, so please spare me.
Young and dumb.
Yes, but it's so interesting. I think a lot of it has to do with age specifically as well. And I kind of think, I was reading an interesting kind of article the other week from Kaki, which is all about like if the point of capitalism is to escape from capitalism, then why do we do capitalism? Yeah. I mean, there's something like that. And it's kind of, you know, it's interesting that like, you know, everyone kind of wants freedom from fear, or from stress, from anxiety. You know, that's what everyone wants, these kind of universal kind of things. And I think that when you're younger as well, or maybe even kind of 10 years ago, like America was or did feel like a safer place. And then you could, and because of the larger canvas kind of creatively, like, yeah, you could go there and kind of do that. And I think when you're younger, you're a bit more kind of in touch with that as well. But I kind of think as you get older, as you start kind of accumulating possessions and experience and everything else.
Tell me, wise man.
Well, there's a tendency to want to kind of, you know, protect those things. Mm-hmm. And I kind of think in general, it's when you see that there's very little stability that, like, you know, even I had to look at with, you know, our office and Bianca and the visa that kind of she's on. It's like, well, it's like in the current administration where things like there's no kind of order or kind of semblance of order anymore, when that can be kind of pulled anytime. Yeah, you have to kind of think, well, what are the actual financial or business implications of that? Like, do I want to kind of continue doing business in such a stable environment? And you look at something like Brexit and how that's going to impact, you know, companies that are kind of physically kind of leaving kind of that space. But I kind of think, yeah, in general, it's like, you know, there's definitely kind of an exciting part of the unknown and kind of the thrill there. But for me, I think it's about kind of condensing and achieving kind of more of this kind of stability and kind of peacefulness. And like, I think, yeah, like that's not, America's not offering that at the moment.
I also
wonder, it's not offering it for a certain type of person, I think.
Yeah, totally. Well, I also wonder as well, sometimes if you, Jeremy, does it play in at all that you can have more of an impact in a smaller population, like with the stuff that you do with advocating for artists and I don't know, the creative community as a whole, do you feel like you can have a broader impact because there's a smaller population here?
You know, that's another thing that I think kind of comes down to age as well. Like I think no matter what, like, you know, moving to a smaller population and coming from America, you can, it's like everyone here, like so many new businesses here had the same story. It's like, well, I spent 3 years in London and I saw this was there and it wasn't in Australia and I kind of brought it here, you know? So I think it's so much easier to pull off those opportunities here. You know, people do it in reverse, like especially for coffee and cafes, you know, hospitality is a huge thing in America.
All the Australian
right now.
Cafes in
exactly.
New York, so funny.
So yeah, it can kind of go both ways, but I think it really depends on what your tolerance for kind of risk is as well. So I kind of, if you go back to kind of the fear article at the beginning as well, like, yeah, that is kind of a big fear of mine, is that you can do that to kind of start with, but then how do you kind of sustain and kind of grow business in that kind of smaller pond as well?
That's true. Luke, I want to know what's the real appeal to you? So other than the fact that you've obviously been there for like almost 7 years and you have a life there and a partner there, and you know, what keeps you there?
Isn't that enough, Lara? Isn't that enough?
Never enough.
I don't know. I feel like, I mean, I suppose there are two answers, and one of them is actually really embarrassing. So of course I'll go with that one first. But
is it squirrels? Do you
actually,
like squirrels?
I love squirrels. Their little hands eating things. Yeah. So I'll never get over it.
It hasn't waned at all. Anyway.
But yeah, I know. I feel like this is like very Australian, but I don't know. I feel like when I was over here, like you said, there's like creatively or for whatever reason, there's this idea of going to New York and making it. And for me, it was kind of like that'd be broken down as long as I make it 1 year. Like I made it, but then I got to a year, I'm like, oh, I'd be embarrassed to go home now. And this is even more embarrassing to admit this out loud, but I just didn't want to kind of go back with my tail between my legs or kind of go back because I was forced to. And so I think like, I mean, once I kind of got over the 5 year mark, I calmed right down. And I know it's silly, but I think so many people kind of just don't want to kind of go back. And they're like, oh, how was New York? Like, oh, it was fine. It kind of sucked. It didn't do very well.
You also don't want it to feel like a holiday. You want it to feel like you lived there, you know, I think is a distinction as well. You don't want it to just people to think that you just went on an extended trip. But I mean, I don't think that's embarrassing to admit at all. I think that's very relatable. Also, thank you for joining my therapy show.
I feel like I email you in like an hour and say, can we cut that out? That's really embarrassing. But I think that the more important thing, at least from my perspective, is I don't know. I think just like the opportunities here are just so immediate. Like the thing I'm doing now, like I, you know, Mark Smelling, this guy, he's like, you know, a big TV guy, really nice guy, really, really talented. But like I had met him working at my last place. Like I wouldn't even work together. I just, you know, met him kind of around the office. And then, you know, I got a call from him one day. He's like, oh, I hear you left Gimlet. Do you want to come work on this documentary with me? You know what I mean? Like, it's very lucky, very, like, very fortuitous, but I just don't see that happening for me in Australia. You know what I mean? Like, and, you know, I did that story for This American Life, which was probably like, you know, my biggest kind of career highlight to date in terms of just kind of exposure, at least. And that would be a lot harder to kind of manifest. Like I met one of the producers when she came to the uni I was going to do a talk, and just kind of like pinned her, you know, I kind of went up and spoke to her afterwards. And, you know, long story short, ended up doing a piece for This American Life, but that wouldn't have been available to me quite so easily, obviously, in Australia. So at least for this stage of my career, I think I've established myself now, but that's only kind of fairly recently. I think I've been kind of climbing and climbing and climbing, and the opportunities here just seem a lot, there are less steps. And actually one other thing about Australia, and we can obviously edit this right down, but there's one thing about Australia as well, which I noticed when I was working there, is that the markets were a bit smaller, and at least in what I was working in, like people were staying in the jobs for a lot longer. And people were rewarded like...
Yes, that's definitely...
Yeah, and they rewarded the amount of time you were doing it. They're like, you need to earn your stripes. You need to earn your stripes. I'd pitch someone a story and they'd be like, have you written for anyone else? And at that time, I'm like, oh, not really, not many places. And they're like, I'll get back to it when you have more clips. Whereas I feel like here, people reward ideas. Like if you have a good idea, like, and people can kind of benefit from that alongside you, then they're more willing to kind of put you forward. So I think you can kind of come here and prosper here in a way that just... isn't available to you, at least in Sydney and in my experience.
I think, yeah, that's such a valid point. And it's interesting because I hear different perspectives from different people who sort of agree with that and who also say kind of the opposite. And I love hearing from someone in your position about how it's sort of panned out for you. And we are also so incredibly happy and, you know, we're the proud Australian people back home that you have gone to New York and you have made it.
Look, yeah, those are really interesting points. I guess to really round things off, though, I'm just kind of curious, like, how do you personally kind of reconcile the political aspect of it? Like, you know, like reading a story like this kind of from the Times, like, how do you kind of, you know, how do you kind of carry that and kind of work with that on a day-to-day basis, like knowing that kind of the same system is... you know, isn't working for kind of other people? Like, is there anything that you feel that you can kind of actively do, or do you have to kind of put it in a black box? Or I'm just kind of curious.
No, that's a really good question. I think I'm so buffeted from the realities of that. You know what I mean? I read about it. It's so different from my experience. And I'm very, very lucky to be in the position I'm in. And it's kind of crazy. Like to get this green card I got, like it's taken like a year and a half. My lawyers are incredibly expensive. It's been a complete slog. And there are so many more steps now than there were before. And like, I'm in like the most privileged position possible. Like, I think it's obviously so much harder for people with asylum claims or coming through with like, you know, with less money and less opportunity behind them. And it's sad and it's fraught. You know what I mean? But I think I was speaking to a friend of mine who's a journalist the other day, and we were kind of talking about this very thing. Like, you know, it's just a bit of a dark time to be in the country, and you do feel it. Like, I think at the beginning, everyone was like, when this administration came into power, people were kind of just suggesting what might happen and talking and predicting what the future might be like. But I think here, 2 years later, like you're really feeling the effects. You see this in terms of kind of the stuff you see in the street, people, like the way people speak to each other, the way, you know, people saying racist things in cafes, maybe a bit more than they were before, or at least it's getting more attention and things feel uglier. But anyway, so I was speaking to this friend of mine and he's like, yeah, like this is a shitty time, but we're also here in one of the most interesting times. And I think if, you know, especially if you're a journalist or journalism adjacent, I think it's, you know, it's important to kind of be here and not to be too grandiose, but to kind of, you know, as much as you can bear witness to what's happening and kind of, and get that out there. So it's would be one thing to kind of be like, oh, I'm Australian. I can go back home and have my, you know, overpriced cafe breakfast and have quite a lovely life. But it's kind of, it's interesting to live here at the very least. It's ugly and it's sad, but it's also interesting and hopefully things change.
Well, some really important insight to take down there. So I appreciate you bringing the link to our attention. And yeah, thank you so much, Luke, for everything. That's some great food for thought.
We appreciate it so
thank
much.
Thank you, guys. It's been fun.
Before we wrap up, it is time for the brilliantly named Thumbs Up, Thumbs Down, Shaka. The time we dedicate each week to get the good, bad, the completely great, and the completely petty off our chest. Why? Because you all have to listen to us and we're going to do it. And you're probably driving. Keep your hands on the wheel. Don't change it. The amount of times I try to fast forward through a commercial and it's taking my eyes off the road, scary.
Jeremy, you have children.
I know.
Think of the children. Jeremy, what about you? Thumbs up, thumbs down, Shaka?
Thumbs up for my new love, Lara Bars.
I was like, Lara? Lara Bars. Yeah, you and your Lara Bars. You've got a secret stash in the office.
I love Lara Bars.
So good.
Is that? not the only secret stash? Are there multiple stashes?
I might just have them hidden around the office. But yeah, I brought a whole bunch back. This is kind of a mixed thumbs up, thumbs down, like, because like thumbs down, they are sold out of my new favorite flavor, cinnamon roll, which is amazing. But like and also a third thumbs up to iHerb as well, you know, who really should sponsor the show because they're amazing.
I know. I talked about iHerb last time.
But yeah, like, you know, I have been kind of, I've had refined sugars out of my diet for the last kind of 2 years or so. And yeah, really kind of have relied on, you know, even though it's kind of semi-processed, it's kind of dates and almonds and, you know, it's all kind of natural. And they're my little afternoon snacks. They're so delicious. They do it really well in terms of all the bloody bars that are kind of out there. Lara Bar gets my endorsement.
They didn't even pay you for this, as far as I know.
They didn't pay me.
They're paying them in Lara Bars.
They can send me some cinnamon rolls if they got some left.
I'm mad because I had a shitty day a couple of weeks ago and you secretly offered me a Lara Bar as consolation and I just like wasn't hungry, so I didn't take it. And now I feel like it's too late to sort of like redeem my voucher.
I'm going to take one anyway. Later.
We'll talk about it
Lara,
later.
Lara, what's yours?
I have a weird, very sort of particular niche personal thumbs up, but my thumbs up is for going to away to sports races and not doing the race. So this weekend I'm going away to the Spartan race, which for any avid listeners of the show might remember I did last year, which was a big race in the hills in Brighton, Victoria. It's horrible. I hated it, but I did it. And my same team are all going to do it again this year. And they're all sort of trying to better their times or they're doing longer races. And people keep asking me why I'm not doing it. And part of the reason is that I broke my foot earlier this year. But the real reason is that I have ticked that shit off my bucket list. Why on earth would I do it again? This year, I'm just going up to spend 4 days walking around beautiful Bright. I'm going to make margaritas. I watch some daytime TV and I'll just console all the others when they get back from their race. So a big thumbs up if anyone has, you know, never thought about trying that before. I really recommend it.
Luke, what do you got? Is there anything you'd like to endorse or kind of disendorse or just talk about?
I will be the counter to your two very positive thumbs up and do a thumbs down. And this, again, I'm going to carry on with the whole kind of Australia versus New York, or at least Sydney versus New York kind of thing, and which is basically winters in New York are just atrocious. We are going into it. I see all my friends back home posting their very first kind of beach Instagrams, and it makes it even more depressing. I got dark today at 5 p.m., and I think it's going to be zero tomorrow with snow.
Oh God. So the novelties well and truly went off, you imagine, after 7 years.
Well, it's just the endless, it's not even the cold, it's the endlessness. Because you know, like right about now is where it starts. And then somewhere near April or May next year, it'll lift. Like that's a long ass time. Yeah. And you get chafing on my thighs, you get your hands dry, everything cracks, everything hurts. It's just a dark, dark time. I think I'm actually going to invest. I was looking before about the best sad lamps. I think it's time to invest in one of them.
I'm sorry. It's just too warm here for me to empathize whatsoever.
Luke, while you are warming yourself with the delicious rays of your sad lamp, where can people find you on the internet?
Okay. I am terrible on social, but the best bet for me is on Twitter. So that's by Luke Malone, and that's my handle. And also Instagram, which is Luke R. Malone.
Excellent. And are you able to give us any hints in terms of what you're working on, when we should keep an eye out for it?
Ooh, I can't tell you what it's about, but it should be, we don't even know yet. It's due to deliver sometime next May, and it could be released, you know, a few months after that, or as late as early 2019. But it's going to be incredible.
Luke, thank you again so much for your time. Really appreciate it. And enjoy winter.
Yeah, thank you so much, guys.
I'm Jeremy Wartzman. She's Lara Chan Baker. This has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business, and we are not doing a speed run this season.
Thank God.
Until I come up with something else. Our theme music is by, totally unrelated to our company, Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/Jackie Winter. If you want more JWGYTV, archives of all of our shows and the links we cover can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. To receive all the links we talk about in the show each week in one neat little package, you can sign up to our podcast-specific newsletter at tinyletter.com/Jackie Winter. Word of warning, though, we will be changing and integrating that into our regular Jackie Winter newsletter, so keep an eye on that soon. You can also find us mostly at Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And you can hit us up with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@JackieWinter.com. If you love what you hear, you can really help us out by subscribing, rating, and leaving us a comment on iTunes, and of course, recommending us to all your mites. as well as iTunes. They can get the show wherever you get podcasts, including Spotify and Stitcher, or for the traditionalists, directly from our website at jackiewinder.givesyouthe.biz. Remember that this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using Pocket Cast, Overcast, or Castro, and now Apple Podcasts, you'll be able to see the links to the articles as we're talking about them. And if you work for an advertising agency or design studio and are interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.rodeo for more info. Thank you for listening. Catch you next week. Until I come up with a better, more catchy way to end the show, I'm just going to say bye-bye, and that's it. So bye-bye. Bye-bye. You going to say bye, Laura?
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for your support and for the emails and everything else. And to anyone just joining us, we promise we've got a great one. Oh, I'm going to just do that one again.
Sure.